Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. Glad again, honored again to be talking to the best audience in mental health, psychology, the whole area of well-being, the best in the world. And you can get my wonderful, not my wonderful interviews, but my wonderful guests going back to 2006 now, on PRN-FM and on podbean.com. It's just a delight to be building up this great archive of the best in the world talking about the things that interest them the most. And today, I'll get to my guest in a minute, is no exception, except that it's exceptionally good, I believe. Dave Traxson is just one of the most fun people to talk to, one of the most interesting and creative. Before getting there, I want to remind folks about Mad in America. You know, I'm a blogger on Mad in America, like many of us are, and don't have any particular involvement in the website. It's run by Bob Whitaker. But I want to just remind folks about how good this website is, Mad in America. I'm looking at it right now. My friend Jacques McLaren from Australia has a blog called Feral Psychiatry, and he analyzes a case, a man, Daniels, that he really rescued. He just rescued Garth Daniels from Australian psychiatry, which is quite similar to American psychiatry. Then there's another article about antidepressants and pregnancy and the risks to the fetus and the child. Another friend of mine from Denmark, Peter Gercher, he's a marvelous physician and researcher. I've invited him to a couple of my conferences in Michigan and Florida last year. He wrote a really good blog on involuntary treatment called Abolishing Forced Treatment in Psychiatry is an Ethical Imperative. It inspired me to write a follow-up blog called Forced Treatment is Torture. Between the two of us, we have 5,000 views at the present time right on Mad in America. And there's a new brain study out on newborns exposed to antidepressants. Their brains are changed. And believe me, when you change the brain of a newborn, it's not for the better, despite what some dogmatic psychiatrists may tell you. So I just wanted to remind folks about Mad in America. It really brings together some of the best work being done in the field today. Now, my guest, Dave Traxson, are you there in Great Britain, Dave? Dave, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, good, good, good. I got nervous for a minute. Dave's last name, Traxson, is T-R-A-X-S-O-N. Dave is what's called a chartered educational psychologist in the U.K. He's a member of the British Psychological Society's Division of Educational and Child Psychologists. He contributed to their analysis of the DSM-5. He contributes to a website, Global Summit on Diagnostic Alternatives. Maybe he can tell us something about that. One of his quotes that I pulled off the website is that to see children as a market expansion opportunity for drugs is ethically corrupt. Today he's going to talk about something that I enjoyed a great deal listening to him about yesterday on our phone call. You know, what can we learn from airplane safety checks? What can we learn from the way they change tires at the racetrack? What can we learn from some of these systematic, rapid efforts to manage safety. What can we learn from that? I thought this was extremely interesting. And in Great Britain, they have some ideas about relating to children, which we have not really quite grabbed yet. And he's going to tell you what he thinks the first and highest priority is of all professionals in regard to their responsibilities for children. And I think if you asked a psychiatrist in the U.S., you know, what's your child psychiatrist, what's your first priority toward a child? You might say something like correct diagnosis and correct medication or something like that. But Dave Traxson is going to tell us what our real responsibilities are toward children. Dave was last on the show in 2014, and I welcome you back. Hello.
No, it's lovely to be back, Peter. Lovely to be back.
Well, I'm just really glad to have you. Would you like to talk about what is the responsibility that professionals really have toward children? It's remarkably unique, I think, if we try to apply it in the U.S.
Well, yeah, I mean, for the last 10 or so years, we work in teams that are called Children's Services, which are multi-professional teams. And the directors of those teams say that our paramount responsibility, our primary responsibility, is the safeguarding of children within our care, within the care of those services. And at every conference you go to, these directors reiterate that. They really ram it home with us that that is our total primary responsibility, is the safeguarding of children. And I think that's the ethical theme that runs through our conversation tonight, that will link all the things we probably talk about, including the exciting ideas from Atul Gawande, which we'll come back to. And linked to that is this notion that I think ties in very nicely with safeguarding, that in the UK, and I know it's true in America, the notion of mindfulness is very, very popular. I mean, even our MPs in the House of Parliament are all being trained in mindfulness so that they become kind of more aware of the moment and more respectful of each other. And a phrase that I really like is the notion of being, at all times, being ethically mindful. And I think that's very powerful, you know, and it's it ties in brilliantly with this notion of safeguarding children at all times. So those two notions of safeguarding and being ethically mindful, I think, can change professional practice.
I think it's really interesting. I mean, mindfulness, of course, goes in our country way back to the 60s, I believe.
Yeah.
And I think it is a powerful tool. I haven't myself had mindfulness training. Some of my audience will know, and others will be astonished to know, that I actually pray. You know, I actually pray to God for peace for myself and strength for myself and for those who of us working together and so on. And I think that prayer comes close to mindfulness. And
yes, I
mildly meditate, but I think that mindfulness is a very good concept.
And I mean, a lot of us use with our clients the notion of affirmations, that you like it's almost cognitive behavioral, that by repeating simple affirmations in your head, it's what some people call, it creates a future memory, which is a concept I really like, that you sort of, by repeating these positive messages about what you can achieve, it's creating this new future, this future memory of what you as a human being can achieve.
I think all of this is really important. I Googled safeguarding children, and, you know, it's all UK. It's not in the U.S., and I just don't know if we even have the concept. I mean, we have laws that professionals have to report abuse by authorities in the child's life, We have child protective services. I'm sure you have something equivalent to that. But this basic concept of safeguarding children, in fact, if you go to health professionals with your child nowadays, they may safeguard your reputation and tell you that you're contributing nothing to your child's problem and then go diagnose and drug the child. We're hardly safeguarding our children.
No, that's right. That's right. And that, I mean, that notion of safeguarding ties in very nicely with an exciting project that I'm involved in at the moment, which is producing what's called a reflective checklist, which I know you, Peter, are aware of. But just coincidentally, yesterday, we had a very exciting development in that the president of the British Psychological Society, Professor Peter Kinderman, who's been on your program, and the British Psychological Society is, you know, is respected around the world as a learned organization. Well, the British Psychological Society yesterday endorsed my idea of a reflective checklist, which, as you said in your introduction, comes from Atal Gawande's seminal book called The Checklist Manifesto. And his inspirational work in surgery was based on the idea of the checklist that is used to get an aeroplane ready for takeoff. And he decided to develop a similar kind of protocol and checklist in the operating theatre, which all the professionals, the anaesthetist and the surgeon and the senior nurses, all abide by and respect and contribute to. And in Scotland, where it's been used widely, they're attributing, you know, very significant gains in success rates and you know, preventing deaths in the operating theatre, you know, which is major stuff. So I decided to take that idea and apply it to this area of ethical practice and safeguarding, and wondered if there were some questions that if prescribing doctors in Britain, those prescribing doctors are child and adolescent psychiatrists and pediatricians, those are the only two groups that can prescribe these drugs. If they were to read these questions first, would it possibly make them reconsider? And I'm hoping that you're going to put these questions on your website. But I mean, I can give you would it be helpful to give a flavor of a couple of them?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really, really
well,
like you to
I'll
do
just
that.
I think I'll just pick three, if that's all right. Three out of the 12. And the idea is that these would be on some kind of desk memo pad, you know, that there would be a permanent feature on prescribing doctors' desks, just for them to skim through with the client there in front of them, you know, the young person there in front of them. So the first one gives you a flavor, you know, are the child's behavioral difficulties pervasive, occurring in a wide range of social settings, and observed by a range of different individuals in the community? Because obviously, for it to be a medical condition, it has to fulfill that kind of rigorous condition. I don't know if there's anything you want to respond to on that, Peter, but that's the first of the list, and then I'll pick two of my other favorites, if you like.
Well, you know, built into the diagnosis of ADHD, which neither you nor I, think, give credibility to, I certainly don't, there is the concept that is this happening in two different settings or three different settings, and nobody pays any attention to it at all. If the child's a little hyperactive at school or at home, they just drug them. I think it's a protection. I think what you're saying is it's a beginning of a protection. And really, it's your whole list.
And we call it triangulating the data in Britain, that a doctor shouldn't be prescribing these drugs unless they have triangulated the data between home, school, and other settings like their clinic or, a youth club or wherever. they need to be triangulated before making that kind of very significant decision about a child's life.
Yes, absolutely. Go through the list and pick out some
more of your favorites. My hot favorite at the moment, I'm actually on the National Institute of Clinical Health and Excellence, one of the committees for health conditions with children. And the one thing that I'm trying to push on that is the notion of participation in sport, or what in the research is called physical activity. And the one that relates to that, the question that relates to that is, has a psychological intervention such as talking therapy, you know, CBT and all those kind of things, or a social intervention such as a buddy system, or a physical intervention such as participation in sport, been tried prior to prescribing this particular psychotropic medication, which is being considered? And I really want this notion of physical exercise to be considered very carefully, because I'm sure you're aware that in France, psychiatrists and doctors have two prescription pads. The one is for a sporting intervention, which is paid for by the state. You know, it's actually so an athletics club or a judo club or a swimming club or a boxing club paid for by the state, which goes on for 6 months to a year. And that is then evaluated by the doctor as to whether it's made any difference. And only then would they proceed to giving a psychotropic drug. And consequently, France's prescription rate of some of the psychotropic drugs is way below Britain, and certainly way below the States. And I think that's another of these very significant safeguards.
One of my favorites, and I think many people's favorites, is the idea of would you provide this medication to a child in your immediate family if a similar pattern of presenting behaviors was occurring?
Absolutely.
I think in America, the misfortune is that the answers from all the psychiatrists is just going to be yes, because they're not meditating on this issue. They're not praying on this issue. They're not doing anything thoughtful about the issue. But I think that's another very good one that would really, if the docs really thought about it each time, it would have a powerful effect. Continue with your list. Let's look at the things you think would turn people around on this drugging children issue.
Well, I think if they did read this reflective checklist, and at the top of it says the three important words, which is just pause, reflect, and review. That's all we're asking people to do, is to just pause for a second, be mindful for a second, then to reflect on the questions that are being posed, and then to review their decision that they're about to take. And Professor Peter Kinderman, who I have huge respect for, who's now president of the British Psychological Society, he, in his letter of endorsement, says that he professionally feels that in itself would bring the prescription rate down of some of these drugs where psychologists feel they're being overused.
And I think it'll give psychologists courage to not just send the kids for drugs, because in the U.S. at least, a lot of referrals from drugs come from the psychologist who does a psychological testing and decides the child has ADHD on the basis of testing. Is that the same thing in the U.K.?
No, it isn't. I mean, no psychologist can prescribe a drug in the U.K.
Well, they can't here either, but they're listed in their alternatives for treatment.
No, we would be in hot water, I think, if we did that. Well, no, we would definitely be in hot water as psychologists in this country if we did that. That would be beyond our remit. One of the strengths that we have working with children is that we often say to them, you know, in our introduction, that we have no power to give them drugs or to take them into hospital, and that we work with young people that have ups and downs, and we work with them by talking with them and talking with their friends and talking with their family and talking with their teachers in order to try and make things better.
Yeah, I mean, our psychology, I don't think anybody in our reform movement in the U.S. would speak as highly of the American Psychological Association as you are of the British Psychological Society. I mean, the American Psychological Association, more and more like the American Psychiatric Association, is just a trade union, and they have been pushing for psychologists, the PhDs, to have prescribing privileges on the basis of special training programs, and this is growing, and this is happening in a number of states in the U.S., as well as in some government services. So, folks, there's a real difference in a lot of ways about what goes on in Great Britain, and you'll notice how many guests disproportionately I have on from Great Britain, because I don't think we're likely to have a president of the American Psychological Association that we can truly admire. I could be mistaken there, and if the current president, I don't know who it is, would like to call and or phone me or let me know why I should admire him and why he should be on a show about reform in the mental health, I'd be glad to talk to him. I think it's a really different environment here in the U.S.
Well, I'd like to just share with you one of my favorite quotes from Professor Peter Kinderman, and that is that we need to remove the D from a lot of these conditions. So we need to remove the D from PTSD. We need to remove the D from SAD, and we need to remove the D from ODD. So it becomes, you know, post-traumatic stress, social anxiety, an oppositional defiance, and to remove to demedicalize distress, I think is his key message, that we need to take the D for disorder out and treat these conditions much more holistically, which includes things like the physical activity that I talked about earlier. I mean, there's lots of research now that shows that increased physical activity and ecotherapy and a big thing from Denmark called the Forest School Initiative, all of those things can reduce mental distress and even have positive impacts with the most serious of conditions like schizophrenia and certainly ADHD and behavioral disorders. And it's not rocket science. Most lay people, if you say, you know, if you take a child for a run or for a bike ride, would they be calmer? And they'd say, of course they would. You know, it really isn't rocket science, is it?
No, and we really do have studies that show things as simple as, I think it was like 10 or 15 minutes exercise before school just reduced all the jitteriness and hyperactivity, probably especially of the boys. It is common sense.
And improves their concentration, you know, and learning outcomes. So it calms them down, but it also improves their the functionality of their brain and the quality of creativity. That all of these things are now coming out of meta-analyses of the use of physical activity.
Yeah, and it's true for every place it's looked at, depression in adults. I mean, it's true for everything, and it's something I advise to my clients and patients, and especially during drug withdrawal, for example, mild exercise, not running around knocking your brains out, just good mild exercise, moderate to mild.
Yeah, absolutely. It improves the breathing. It changes the oxygen balance and carbon dioxide balance in the blood. And like so many breathing exercises, it's that balance of oxygen and carbon dioxide that then has this calming effect that affects the whole body.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the interesting things about your work is that it's having an effect in the establishment. And I think that's a really good thing. I noticed that Alan Francis, the psychiatrist who was so heavily involved in DSM-4 and now is complaining about 5, and who's taken tons of money from drug companies but wants to look like a reformer, he's got a blog in Psychiatric Times about on their website about your checklist. And
no, absolutely.
How that, yes.
He's done one on the checklist that I've just illustrated, and one on a checklist that we did together for parents, you know, with similar sort of questions, but much more focused on parents being mindful of the alternatives before they cooperate with drugging their own child, you know.
One of the things I understand from talking more with you and talking with Peter Kinderman is, I mean, you're really not in favor of the psychiatric drugs. But what you're doing, which is interesting, is that instead of just hammering that in the face of everyone, you're proposing methods that are going to have to force people to think more about what they're doing.
No, that's the secret. And I mean, we've had a positive initial response from the Royal College of Psychiatry, you know, the most important body for psychiatrists in Britain. And their president, Sir Simon Wesley, he's professor as well, you know. He's shown an initial interest in the idea of a reflective checklist, because I'm sure it's true in America, but this notion of being a reflective practitioner is a really big issue on a lot of our training courses for a number of professions to do with mental health, that you have to be a reflective practitioner in order to be an effective practitioner.
Oh, my. By the way, folks, we're talking again with Dave Traxson, Traxson. Marvelous psychologist from Great Britain. I'm just sitting here grinning. I wish this was on video, because no, David, American professionals do not get that kind of training in the mental health field. Reflective? Reflect about what? The DSM-5? I mean, we don't reflect over here in our field. Unless you're outside the mainstream. Nobody would ever bring, I think, those kind of concepts into the mainstream. I'd just be very surprised to see anything like that. And, you know, it's interesting. Great Britain is definitely moving much more toward letting go of traditional even diagnosis. Some of the guests I've had on from Great Britain, especially with children, in the field of psychiatry itself, child psychiatry, they're talking more and more about describing the child's situation. I forget what the term is, but describing this to child's context and situation rather than diagnosing the child. There's a real movement in that direction.
Yeah, much more what we call a holistic assessment. And many of us feel there's it's actually a systemic failure that's happening at the moment, to look at things systemically from other than just a medical model, you know, to move it towards a much more integrated assessment that involves obviously the medical model, but involves the social model and the environmental model all the family dynamics as well. And to include all of those things in a very kind of holistic assessment of children's needs.
You know, you'd find this model more in American psychiatry if you went back to the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah.
I mean, there was very much an effort to be more integrative in psychiatry, and and that was fairly mainstream, especially for children. And you even had in England and the U.S., psychiatrists like Harry Stack Sullivan and Karen Horney, who were literally talking about psychology as the fundamental root of human distress, and Harry Stack Sullivan talking about interpersonal psychiatry, about the relationships between people and between the therapist and the psychiatrist. So psychiatry doesn't necessarily make progress like you'd expect a science to make.
No.
It actually is more like politics. It can get worse and worse, or it can get better and better, depending on many different things.
Right,
and in the U.S., it's worse than ever right now.
I mean, I know you like some of my little phrases that I put together, and one that I put together in relation to holistic assessment, which causes people to think when I'm doing some training, is that I say that what we need is a naturalistic narrative of need, of the young person's needs. We need a story about their needs, rather than, and this is where people sort of raise an eyebrow, rather than a dysfunctional discussion of dubiously diagnosed disorders. And I always say to them, you know, I'm a big fan of alliteration, and perhaps 5 D's is too many, but tell me which D to get rid of. You know, a dysfunctional discussion of dubiously diagnosed disorders. And the audience say, well, all of those D's stand true, you know, that it is often dysfunctional. It's not always dysfunctional. I'm not saying it's always dysfunctional, but it is often dysfunctional. And it is often based on dubious checklist diagnoses.
Oh, you know, from my viewpoint, it's always dysfunctional. You know, in my practice, just dovetails with what you're saying, I try to help people understand their story. How in the world did they get to be in a situation that is failing for them? And what are their strengths and their genuine desires to rewrite this story, or at least rewrite its direction and its future? It's about your story. It's not about your diagnosis.
And an exciting metaphor that we're using on some really exciting training that we're doing is what we call a mapping metaphor. And we have, I mean, I'm sure you have the same in America, but we have our maps in Britain are called Ordnance Survey maps, you know, very detailed maps. And what we do is use that as a metaphor for young people, and we say, where are the high points in your life? Where do you feel safe? Where do you feel happy? Where do you get full fulfillment? And where are the places, the dark places, the valleys and the caves and the places where you feel frightened and the places where you feel unsafe? And where are the places that interest you? And where are the places that you get nourishment? And where are the places that you feel unsure of yourself or feel lacking in confidence? And by getting young people to sometimes very physically draw these maps or illustrate them with post-its or felt-tip pens or whatever, it helps their story to kind of emerge. And we've had a lot of quite profound sort of changes from young people just from being more aware of what their map is and the direction they want to choose to go in. Very powerful metaphor.
Now, are you aware of any place in American psychology that this kind of idea is taking root and being taught? I mean, I don't know what's being taught in schools of psychology.
No, I mean, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is, because, I mean, you know, obviously there's creative ideas in all cultures, but these ideas in Britain, I mean, they've come from, you know, sources like family therapy and dynamic family therapy and solution focused brief therapy. That's where we've drawn a lot of these ideas from.
I don't think there's a lot of that in your typical clinical psychology program anymore. I could be wrong. Maybe there are some really good ones around, but my sense, going even to Humanistic Psychology Association conferences, that the orientation is more and more like conventional psychiatry here in the U.S.
Right. Well, I hope that's not the case, totally, you know, because, I'm, you know, but certainly that's the way we're moving in Britain, you know. And the holistic nature of assessment is being taken much more seriously. And that all things stem from mental distress. And by understanding where the mental distress comes from, you get a better idea of how to proceed and to support the young person, or eventually the adult. And people like, you've had Lucy Johnson, I think, on your program. You know, people Lucy Johnson are pioneers in that area of work in Britain, you know.
I do think a lot more is going on in Great Britain than in the U.S. I think you're much less under the club of the pharmaceutical industry than here in the U.S., where even family therapy, which is certainly the most effective way of helping children, is family interventions, where the parents take responsibility for changing and improving the way they're relating to the children. I mean, that's largely been squashed for funding by NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, CHAD, these other groups that get drug company funding and then influence NIMH and the Department of Education and so on here. So it's really exciting for me when I talk with colleagues from Great Britain, because there is better stuff going on there. There's still conventional psychiatry and a lot of it, I'm sure, but there's much better things going on there.
A lot of the things I'm talking about are from psychology colleagues, you know, both clinical psychologists like Lucy Johnson and Peter. Obviously, Peter Kinderman's a clinical psychologist, but there's a lot of creative work going on in educational psychology as well, the field that I work in, and forensic psychology and family psychology. So, you know,
In psychiatry itself, you've got Sammy Tamimi, who is just doing really good stuff as a child psychiatrist. Somewhat against the grain, but he's able to do it, which is just remarkable. Do you know Sammy? Do you work with him at all?
Yes, absolutely. No, I've done some. We work regularly together on conferences, and I haven't worked with him in his geographical area of where he works, which is Lincolnshire. But we're on the same wavelength, and we certainly contributed to conferences on similar themes, and we both try to be creative in ways that we describe situations. I mean, you liked my one last time of psychoeconomic imperialism, which caused a bit of a stir. You know, the chemical colonization of young minds for huge commercial profit and social control. I thought that you quite like that.
Oh, and, I like it again. You could even say it again. Say it again.
Psychoeconomic imperialism, which is the chemical colonization of young developing minds for huge commercial profit and social control. And I've sort of, I thought I'd try and work on something for this program, you know, just to be, to build on that. And it's similar in some ways, but it's the notion of psychopharmaceutically induced isolation is the one that I've come up with for our conversation tonight. That it's that young people are having a form of isolation induced into them by pharmaceutical drugs, where they're feeling lonely and lost and confused and more anxious as a result of the drugs. They're having poor sleep as a result of some of the drugs, and they're having all sorts of other physical symptoms, which you're obviously an expert in. And this, it's like a biochemical cocoon that they're in. Another phrase that I mentioned to you last night is, you know, the notion of being chemically incarcerated. That these young people, who are the most vulnerable groups in society are sort of feeling when they've had some of these medicines. Not always, you know, because sometimes they do have benefits, but they're often feeling very isolated from the children around them and from their families and from society as a result of taking the medications, not before they've taken the medications. And that's a huge question for society, I feel. Why are we inducing this state of mind, you know? And many head teachers talk of children that, you know, were very creative and absolutely bundles of energy, and after treatment they've become subdued, and one head used the phrase a walking ghost, that this child had become a walking ghost within the school compared to their previous personality factors, you know. It's terrible, you know, when it's happening on a large scale, as it is in, you know, many countries.
What percent? excuse me. What percentage of children in Great Britain are on psychiatric drugs compared to the U.S.?
Well, I think it's much less. I mean, I don't. I mean, obviously, we know the figures for individual drugs, but I would imagine overall we're talking about 5 to 10%, whereas in America there's more than 5 to 10% just on psychostimulants, aren't there? Some reports talk about 25% of children in America being on. One or more psychotropic drug. And then you add to it vulnerable groups like children in care, which we call in Britain looked after children, and they're the most vulnerable children that have had traumatic life experiences. And the percentage of children on various categories of drugs goes much, much higher. One article I read on the Madden America site, which you gave a plug for, that was that 40% of children in state care with a diagnosis of ADHD, and it's a recent article, the last week or so, 40% of them are not on stimulants, but they're on antipsychotic drugs. 40% of children in care diagnosed with ADHD are on antipsychotic drugs.
Yeah, it's a disaster. In some places, just about all the children on foster care, for example, are on drugs. It's an incredible disaster. You know, and I want to come back to this idea of, chemically induced isolation or psychopharmaceutically induced isolation. We really do know what the stimulant drugs do. Back in the 1990s, I was the expert on adverse drug effects in children for a great big federal conference that was being put on by NIMH and NIH, that is the mental health and the health institutes. And I got invited in toward after it had been all formulated by the office of the director of the National Institutes of Health. I got directly invited to come into this conference because nobody was talking about adverse drug effects, and I was made the expert on that. And I called the person who was the head of the conference. He was at NIMH. First name, same as mine, Peter, and he. Was the kind of like a world expert on ADHD and drugs, and I said, you know, Peter, we have a lot of animal research on how the drugs work, what they do, in chimpanzees, large animals, mammals. We have a lot of research, and he said, no, there isn't any. I said, well, I'm going to present some at the conference. I'm not only going to do adverse effects. I'm going to talk about the primary effects, which are indeed adverse effects, and what the So, I mean, here is somebody who is like supposed to know it all, and he didn't know anything. And if you look at the animal research, and you think about a chimpanzee, this is so relevant to the isolation idea.
Yeah.
Chimps are like children. They want to play. They kiss. They hug. They fight, not usually with any great damage, but they do. They fight among themselves. I'm not talking about the alpha male kind of struggles. They like to explore. They like to play. They even kiss. They're really a lot like children. They don't want to be in a cage. They don't want to be in a classroom. They want to be roaming free. Now, if you give a chimp,
they want to be curious, don't they?
Very, very curious creatures. They're really very close to us in a lot of ways, and the genetics are quite close to ours. Now, if you give one of them a clinical level of stimulant proportional to their body weight, two things happen to them. First, and primary, all of their spontaneous behavior, however measured, is reduced.
Yeah.
Or even crushed. They don't socialize as much. They don't play as much. They don't groom as much. So they become much more isolated. And the second thing that they do is they become OCD. So they'll play with a pebble rather than something more interesting. They'll gnaw on a bar. They'll pick at their skin. Now, if you do legitimate studies of children, and I file them up in some of my books on children and on my brain disabling treatment and psychiatry. I look at these studies, and you find the same things in children. Basically, drugs are crushing spontaneity, and they're causing OCD. And that looks really great to the teachers who want kids to sit down, shut up, and copy things off the board so hard in their OCD that they're literally tearing the paper. But the kids aren't learning anything. There's no indication of better or any kind of improved psychosocial development. In fact, many of them become depressed and OCD and withdrawn. So I think isolation, we know that stimulating those neurotransmitter systems has a huge effect on front lobe function and limbic function and the ability to relate, isolated.
Absolutely. And it's the complete opposite outcome of what we want schools or social networks to achieve, isn't it? You know, and the same with curiosity. I mean, we want children to be intensely curious. The brightest people in the world are intensely curious. So why do we give them compounds that make them less curious, you know? Is it just for social control?
Well, I have no doubt that it is, even within the family and probably on a much larger scale of maintaining our educational system and maintaining a society in which we don't have individualism anymore. We don't have people standing up for themselves. We don't have people who are rambunctious becoming adults who are, you know, threatening to social control. I think that this is something that that we do need to be reminded about. This is a large scale kind of suppression that's going on in the U.S. As I think about it, David, and again, we're talking with David Traxson, Traxson, a British psychologist. As I think about education in the U.S., back in the 1960s, and I was actually a consultant at NIMH in education and children full-time back in the 60s, we had many more educational innovations coming through in the 60s than we do now.
Yeah,
I think that's
one
of the facts where the drugs are so important to the establishment. We don't have to try to fund, explore, and experiment with innovation. What's happening with innovation especially the elementary school level in Great Britain? Is it more interesting and hopeful than in the U.S.?
I think it's exactly the same scenario here in the 60s and 70s and 80s, there were some amazingly exciting experiments going on. There was a famous educationist called Sir Alec Clegg, who wrote a book, Children in Distress, and which was a seminal book in the 60s and 70s. And his view was that in the mornings you should do all the emotional stuff. You should do the drama, you should do the sport, you should do the art, you should do the poetry, you should do the construction and making things, anything that kind of expressed an emotion. And by that way, you'd be processing their feelings that they had brought to school with in the morning, you know. And then, and this was in a huge area of Yorkshire called the West Riding of Yorkshire. And in the afternoons, you did the academic stuff. Well, now, because of what we call the national curriculum, it's a complete reverse. You know, the whole morning is spent doing one academic subject after another, and the emotional stuff and the creative stuff is sort of is squeezed out a bit. And you know, and I think that's been a major shift in Britain, which has had its consequences. You know,
Americans, my friends in America, my fellow citizens, listen to this message. Giving things to the federal government does not necessarily at all bring an improvement, and it tends to stifle creativity. It stifles creativity, and God, we see it in our educational system as it becomes more and more run by our federal government, more and more. It isn't a good thing. The very creation of the Department of Education has not elevated, but rather suppressed education in America. And the Department of Education has been one of the big pushers of the concept of ADHD and of drugging children. I mean, it was right there very early on in the 80s and 90s, pushing, even promoting videos that were basically advertisements for drug company products.
And the thing that a lot of psychology colleagues in Britain find very surprising and hard to take that happens in America is the notion of children being prescribed drugs by court order, you know, which I know has been a campaign of some leading politicians to challenge it, but that children are given, especially children in state care, are given these drugs under court order. And if they, if the foster parents refuse to cooperate, then the foster parents are prosecuted. And if the children refuse to take them, then often they're given those, you know, a team comes out and gives them the drug by, even intravenously sometimes, you know, because it's a court order. And that is a very significant issue for civil liberties, isn't it?
Oh, it's a huge problem. And I've been an expert on behalf of parents in these situations where, when both parents don't want the child to have drugs, the state intervenes. I had one case in West Virginia where a mother protested her child being in a state hospital where he had been sexually abused and where they wanted to drug him and they wouldn't let him out and they wouldn't listen to the parents not wanting him drugged. And I did a video, interactive video with a judge, me doing an interactive video from, at the time, Washington, D.C., Bethesda, Maryland, and in the courtroom was a psychiatrist from the state hospital, the commissioner of mental health of the county, and another official, all telling the judge, give this kid drugs against the will of the parents and against Dr. Bregan. But the judge, bless the judge said, no, I'm sending the child home, and I'm empowering Dr. Bregan to consult with the local physicians and to help them withdraw the child from drugs. But boy, fantastic. That's like, I mean, that's so great, but that's so uncommon, work. It's a real problem. The courts tend to go along with the prevailing authorities, always.
Yeah, yeah. And as we know, some of, there's a lot of articles, again, on Mad in America, aren't there, about the increasing use of antidepressants and how that can lead to increased levels of violence, both to the person themselves, the young person themselves, in the form of self-harm or attempted suicide, and violence to others, because of the increase in energy level that antidepressants sometimes generate. And there's many, many more articles now on that area of concern. And so why are we giving a drug that's supposed to lift a person's mood that makes the mood a more negative one of aggression and violence? It's illogical.
It's bizarre. You know, and I was writing in 1991 in Toxic Psychiatry, 2 years after Prozac came out, that it was causing violence and suicide. I mean, it wasn't a mystery at all. By the way, on June 8th, I had on the show Irving Kirsch, who is at Harvard and a psychologist, and has done this remarkable analysis showing the antidepressants aren't antidepressants. They don't work. Oh, it's such a crazy world we're in. We've got 2 minutes left, a little less than 2 minutes, and
we had a brief conversation last night about risperidone, didn't we? And risperidal, you know,
we'll have to do another show on risperidone.
Because the hormonal harm that's been doing to children that have been on it long term.
Well, let's talk about possibly doing a show on that, whether you would like to spend a whole hour on antipsychotic drugs in children with me. It's something that's extremely dear to me.
I'm not sure I've got the expertise to dwell on it for a whole hour, but I'll do a lot of talking too.
Hey, thank you for being on. Dave Trax, T-R-A-X-S-O-N, brilliant British psychologist. Thank you.
No, a pleasure, and I hope you put the checklist on your website.
Okay. I will. Send it to me.